This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The scrambling continues over the fallout from President Trump's executive order on immigration and refugees. On Friday, U.S. District Judge James Robart ruled in favor of a lawsuit presented by Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. Ferguson argued that the executive order caused immediate and irreparable harm to the state of Washington. Judge Robart's ruling has a nationwide effect, though, because it immediately halted the key provisions of that executive order, meaning people from those seven banned nations may enter the U.S. through normal channels. And refugees whose arrival was suspended by the decree have begun to be rushed into the U.S. while the ban is lifted. It should be said, though, just to be clear, that the refugees being booked to travel to the U.S. are those who were already screened and approved by Homeland Security and other agencies. At any rate, there's still a lot of turmoil and confusion. As we go live in the noon hour, the Trump administration has a few more hours to file its last objections to this court order. A federal judge in San Francisco will rule soon on the appeal. And eventually, probably soon, this case is very likely to come before the U.S. Supreme Court. Last week, we spoke with Middlebury College professor Atta Anzali. He was due to fly back to Vermont from Iran, where he was visiting family. He decided not to fly for fear of getting caught up in the confusing immigration situation. But he did arrive back in the U.S. this past Friday. When he spoke to us last week, Anzali told us that the changes in policy had people in Iran questioning the idea that the United States is a nation of laws.
No, they're kind of really flabbergasted when they see, you know, like one day there is something and then next day there is something else. And it's just such a fluid situation with the government. And they start thinking about, you know, like what is going on in a country where they thought it's basically the rule of law and there's like everything would be calculated and that kind of, you know, like a very disciplined way of governance and civic society. So it's a lot of confusion, I think. You know, people can't understand what is happening.
Today, we're going to spend the first part of the show looking at what happened over the weekend and how Vermont officials are approaching these issues. And I'm joined now by Vermont's Attorney General, T.J. Donovan. T.J. Donovan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Atta Anzali was talking about this idea of a country that operates under the rule of law and that some people are questioning if that's still true. Is this, in fact, what rule of law looks like, the way a president's executive orders can be taken and then what happens in the courts?
Well, it is rule of law in the sense that this is being played out in the courts, which, you know, let's say at the outset that the judiciary is an equal branch of government, but a separate branch of government, and is really used as a check on as to the other two branches, the executive, the presidency, as well as the legislative. And this is how our government was designed, and it's working exactly as it should. Obviously, there's some commentary on the side about whether or not courts can rule on this or should. I think they should. This is the proper place for these questions to be answered and to be settled. And the judiciary is going to be the key on all these issues, not just on this executive order, but I think over the next 4 years.
Listeners, if you have a question for the Attorney General, now's the time to call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. We have him for a short amount of time today. Again, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a question on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Attorney General Donovan, in a New York Times article outlining the lawsuit in federal court that has at least for now overturned the ban, the New York Times reports Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson saying that he invited other states to be a part of this lawsuit, and only Minnesota jumped on board immediately. Were you aware of the lawsuit, and why did you choose not to join on Vermont's behalf, for now at least?
Yeah, no, we were, and that's exactly what happened. And we're continuing to talk with other states, and in fact, today those conversations go on, and there are going to be other opportunities to join in and to add our voice in opposition to President Trump's executive order. The issue in this case, from the outset, has been the issue of standing, which means essentially this. What is the harm or the injury done to the state And Washington was very unique in a sense, as opposed to New York, Massachusetts, and Virginia that also filed. But they joined pending cases that the ACLU had brought for folks who had been detained at airports when the executive order was signed into effect. Washington did not have anybody detained, and this question of standing is one that is a threshold question. And the Washington's argument is essentially that the harm is one of economic harm to the state's tech industry, to its state universities, to its healthcare, to its finance, to these other industries, and as a result, they have standing to challenge the constitutionality of the president's executive order. We are doing the same in Vermont. We are collecting information about the harm done to our state. As you said in the outset, Jane, in terms of the Middlebury professor, we're watching very closely whether or not, and I've been in contact with his Vermont lawyer in terms of whether or not he was going to get in Friday evening. So the question of standing is one of what is the harm done to a state? What is the specific harm done to Vermont? We're in the process of gathering information from different sectors in this state in terms of the injury. And at the same time, we are talking with Washington. We are talking with other states, and we are considering getting involved.
So considering it, when might you make a decision?
I think there will be a decision later today.
Can you tell us what you're leaning towards?
You know, I think this is a question that impacts equal protection, impacts civil rights, impacts the Constitution, impacts due process of law, and impacts basic tenets of fairness.
So it sounds like you'll be joining that lawsuit.
And that we are a nation of immigrants. That has been our history. That has been our strength. It will continue to be our strength, even here in Vermont. And I think those questions that are being litigated in Washington are not confined to the borders of Washington, but it is a question that is uniquely American. And I think Vermont has a role to play.
We're talking with Vermont Attorney General T.J. Donovan, and if you have a question for him, if you want to know a little bit more about what's been happening in Vermont in reaction to the president's executive order, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's bring another voice into this conversation as well. Tristram Coffin is a former U.S. attorney for Vermont, now a litigator at Downs Racklin Martin. Tris Coffin, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
You're watching all of this news and following some of the national movement with deeper knowledge than perhaps most people based on your history as a U.S. attorney in Vermont. What are your observations?
Well, I think it's clear that some of the quick changes that were implemented through these executive orders really touched a nerve with people around the country. And I think, frankly, I think our citizenry has generally been sort of surprised that with the extent of the changes proposed, the apparent lack of thorough vetting through sort of the traditional agency and congressional sources and experts. And I think we've been surprised with each other as citizens that, you know, the Attorney General was saying, we are a nation of immigrants, and that really stands for something that's kind of at the core of American values. And these orders appear to cut so harshly against that grain that I think there's been a huge outpouring of widespread concern.
Can you explain just briefly how the U.S. Attorney's Office serves both federal and state priorities? As I said, you were a U.S. attorney for the state of Vermont. That's a federal office, but you're operating in Vermont. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the competing priorities?
Sure. So the U.S. attorneys, there's 93 of them across the country. They're appointed by the president. So new president, typically, but not always, you get a new U.S. attorney. The president is obviously the head of the executive branch, one of the three co-equal branches of the United States. That president will appoint an attorney general. And the president, you know, a new president will bring with the new president some new policies, which will be implemented by the attorney general. Now, how that kind of affects how what a U.S. attorney's job does varies from administration to administration. The degree to which individual U.S. attorneys in districts throughout the country have flexibility or latitude from the main justice policies has been something that's varied with the different administrations. But fundamentally, you know, as I think the primary purpose of the Justice Department is to pursue justice. That's not a self-defining term, and it's something that has to be developed and defined through the policy prerogatives of the executive branch, passed through the attorney general to make sure that you're always pursuing that cause of pursuing justice, and leavened through the U.S. attorneys in these different districts who are aware of the differing needs of their particular locations. But a U.S. attorney is a federal official and charged with application of federal law. That being said, a key part of what a U.S. attorney does is to work with state and local counterparts to work together to achieve the goals of the public, both in terms of public safety, justice, national security, all those things. Because working together, you know, experientially has shown that you really have great force multipliers available, and the taxpayers basically can get more bang for their buck. There are issues that can come up, and you may see this happening now when suddenly a federal policy is put into place that seems to run counter to significant state interests and widely felt beliefs of the citizenries of certain communities.
Yeah, you said we may be seeing that play out now. And on Friday, your successor, the U.S. Attorney Eric Miller, announced his resignation with a very pointed statement. The U.S. attorney, though, does serve at the pleasure of the president. There's no sign that I know of that Eric Miller was about to be removed from that position and that President Trump had found somebody that he would prefer to have in that position, although it's certainly within his right. So how does that political tension play out when perhaps a U.S. attorney doesn't agree with the new administration?
Well, you know, Eric did a terrific job, and I think he thinks it's unfortunate for Vermont. It's unfortunate that he didn't get a chance to continue on in that. But a new president will come in with sometimes different priorities, and for a U.S. attorney, those different priorities can raise a challenge. You know, will that U.S. attorney feel comfortable applying those priorities of a different president? You know, that's a question that kind of depends on what the priorities are that are articulated by a new administration, and may vary from U.S. attorney and administration to administration. But it's not too surprising that with a new president, and particularly one coming in with such, you know, significant differences in application of the law, that prosecutors who have been appointed under the prior administration may not feel comfortable staying on.
We're talking today to Tris Coffin, a former U.S. attorney for the District of Vermont, and T.J. Donovan, Vermont's attorney general. And let's hear now from Eric, calling in from Fletcher. Hi, Eric. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you. It sounds like Vermont is about to join this lawsuit. And my question is, for a state, who is so strapped for cash, where we struggle even to send our kids to school, how are we going to pay, and where are the resources going to come from? I personally come from a family of immigrants. However, there was no special treatment for me. We came in the right way and did things the way we're supposed to. And, you know, I just struggled very, very much. I worked an excessive amount of hours to send my kids to good schools, quality schools. And I feel we should be putting our resources at better things than political retaliatory actions, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure you see it different. But my main question is, where are these funds coming from?
Eric, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. I do want to point out that when we're talking about President Trump's executive order, the one that we're talking about does not apply to illegal immigrants. We're talking about people who are visa holders or people who may have in the past been able to enter the United States and or refugees. So to the point, though, Attorney General Donovan, that Eric is making about paying for joining a lawsuit or taking action against a president's executive orders, where does that money come from?
Sure. First, let me say to Eric, I appreciate his personal story. And I think Eric's personal story of coming from a family of immigrants is consistent with many Vermonters, including my own. My grandparents were immigrants, and absolutely right. Nobody got any special treatment. They worked hard. They pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps, and they contributed to our community. They worked. They paid taxes. They tried to provide a life better for their children and their grandchildren, and that is the American story, and that is why this case is at issue that is so fundamental not only to Vermont's future, but I think to our nation's future. And he's also right about asking the financial question. And one of the issues that I've set as a threshold question is the financial impact on the state of Vermont should we join. And as I said earlier, Jane, we are certainly considering it. The question of the financial impact on Vermont is one that I am cognizant and sensitive to and will not put the funding of our state at risk, and there are different ways to get involved into a lawsuit. You can certainly file different sorts of briefs that I don't think there would be any cost to the state. So as I said, we're not haven't made any final decisions, but the caller's right. We are cognizant of the financial impact. I think a third of the Vermont state budget is federally funded, and that's a factor in this analysis. It has to be. That said, you have to balance this issue of human rights, of equal protection of the law, of due process of the law, and what our values and traditions are. I think Eric's story is like my family's story and so many people's story. We are a nation of immigrants, and this is about not only honoring our past, honoring our law, standing up for the rule of law, but giving future generations an opportunity for a better life. That is the America that I know, and that's the Vermont I am going to defend.
Let's go to Liesl calling in from Stowe now. Hi, Liesl. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I'm hearing a lot of talk about the economic implications and the financial impact and looking at those different topics. But I'm also curious about, you know, human interest stories, because I'm engaged to an Iranian and he's stuck in Iran, and, you know, we're trying to do the right thing and going through the fiancé visa program, et cetera. But, you know, I don't know how many people are like me and having difficulties with that situation. Obviously, or may not be obviously, but, you know, here's a man who's highly educated, trying to come to this country to make a better life for himself, and brings a lot with him. I'm just wondering, you know, does that impact any decision making going on in Vermont?
TJ Donovan?
Sure. Well, as Tris knows, again, this comes down to an issue of standing. And from the state's perspective, you're looking at harm to the state in terms of an instrumentality of a state college, a state employee, a public university, and looking in the aggregate, of course, of the economic harm. And so that is the area that you have to be looking at right now. In terms of the individual stories, they're compelling. But when we're talking about challenging the federal government, it's very limited in a sense of standing in the shoes of a private citizen for the state, the legal term, the Latin, parens patriae, standing in the shoes of the citizen against the federal government. It's limited in terms of that threshold legal point of standing. You have to get past the standing argument in order to make the argument regarding the underlying constitutionality of the executive order. And so what's going on in Washington right now is really a legal question as to the standing of Washington to file the temporary restraining order, which the court did grant Friday, which the federal government appealed to the Ninth Circuit for an emergency stay, which was denied. When that is being briefed right now and will probably be argued this week, I should note this. What's interesting about this is likely, regardless of the decision at the Ninth Circuit, this will likely be appealed to the United States Supreme Court, which of course is still 4-4. And if in terms of
liberal and conservative leaning justices,
and not having the ninth justice, and if it's a tie at the United States Supreme Court, the lower court, meaning the Ninth Circuit's decision, would carry the day. So this is, and as Tris said, this is moving extremely fast, and it's changing not just by the day, but by the hour, if not by the minute. And we are trying to stay abreast of everything, of working with other states, of really understanding the chessboard here in terms of the federal appellate practice. It should be noted, Jane, as Tris knows, Massachusetts lost the same legal question on Friday afternoon on the issue of standing in the First Circuit. Vermont's part of the Second Circuit. Washington is part of the Ninth Circuit. So a lot of different pieces on the board, and Tris, as that federal prosecutor, certainly knows this better than I in terms of making sure that you're talking with your counterparts in different states and understanding who should go first and why.
Well, on that note, Tris Coffin, how would the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Vermont be working on this right now? Again, we don't have Eric Miller on the show right now, but you served under two presidential administrations and certainly know well how that kind of in and out works.
Well, in this kind of a case, the U.S. Attorney's Office here, as in all cases, would be representing the United States. And so the attorney generals who may be suing in various states may find themselves having the United States on the other side of them, represented by members of the United States Attorney's Offices or individual United States attorneys. So, you know, really that is how that would play out. What the attorney general said in terms of choosing different forums and where to proceed with a particular lawsuit because it might be more sympathetic to the arguments that are being made are all, you know, super important questions. You know, you hope that there's enough time being taken to coordinate and have an effective strategy presented because there's some risk that it goes off as a scattershot with results that could differ based on lots of different lawsuits pending in different places. But I'm sure there's consideration being given to that, and there'll be more consideration given to that, you know, as time rolls on.
And I should say more consideration given to this topic by Vermont Edition as well. We're going to leave it there for today, but we certainly will continue to follow what's happening nationally and how it affects us here in Vermont and look at how it affects us on the border with Canada. Tris Coffin is former U.S. attorney for the District of Vermont, now a lawyer in private practice. Tris, thanks very much.
Thanks, Jane.
T.J. Donovan is Vermont's Attorney General. We'll look forward to hearing more from you today, T.J. Donovan.
Thanks, Jane. Appreciate it.
Just ahead, a different perspective on Vermont's changing dairy industry. We head out to a farm with students who've captured farmers' stories for a new podcast. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As part of their senior seminar, a group of Middlebury College students is taking a close look at the Vermont dairy industry. One team of environmental studies students took on the issue of farm viability and decided to relate their farm findings in a series of three podcasts that they call Cow Talk. I recently spoke with two members of that team about their project, seniors Christina Ohl and Ginevra Wetmore. Christina explained what led them to make a podcast about dairy farming and the future of dairy.
The class was something that's part of the environmental studies program at Middlebury, so there's a tradition that the final year that you are a major in environmental studies, you take the senior seminar in environmental studies. And the theme for the class always changes, and it's actually based off of student votes. So we're given a couple of options at the beginning of the semester, and we vote on one. So the class voted on doing dairy farming in Vermont and looking at a broad spectrum of different issues within that. So our group was on dairy farm viability, but there were a variety of different projects that were also going on at the same time in the class.
Like the environmentalism issues and pollution. I mean, I think some of that was tackled as well, right?
There was water quality as well as biomethane, digesters, and migrant justice specifically.
So your group was tackling viability, and you start each podcast by talking about how important farming is to the Vermont economy, but also questioning its future. And you interviewed a bunch of farmers about what their lives are like and what they see as the future of farming and how that's going to work and succession plans and, you know, lots of stuff that we don't necessarily hear about when we're just driving along looking at the farms. Ginevra, you've actually had experience on dairy farms. You work on dairy farms?
Yeah, I work on one near my house. I live on a small sheep farm, and then I work on Billings Farm dairy. So it's kind of a farm open to the public. That's how they survive. And it's also a working dairy farm.
Do you think there are misconceptions or stereotypes about farmers in Vermont that you want to clear up?
I think maybe there's a certain stereotype of a lack of awareness or lack of knowledge. We associate nowadays farming with water quality issues. And I think that a lot of the people I talk to don't realize how aware farmers are of these issues. They know what's happening. They're really intelligent. So that's probably the biggest one, but a lot of them. There are a whole bunch.
Christina, what do you think about what you learned during this course that surprised you or that you didn't know about farming and dairy?
Well, I agree with Ginevra about the stereotype of a lack of knowledge. I think also related to that, we had a stereotype this misconception going in that dairy farmers are very isolated and that there's not really a lot of communication going on between them or between other parties. And that was something we were also surprised by and that we learned about, is that dairy farmers, along with also being very knowledgeable of what's going on, they're in communication with each other all the time about different solutions and different things they can do to improve.
Let's listen to a little bit of one of the interviews that you conducted. And one of the topics that you covered, as I mentioned, was the plan of succession from parents to children, or from who's going to take over the farm once the current farmers are too old or would like to retire. So this is Jeep Madison, and he's an organic dairy farmer from Shoreham, and his son is eventually going to take over the farm.
When we get the final milk check of the month, we sit down and settle up. He has to pay for his grain, but we pay for everything else, like his vet bills. Before he knows it, he'll have a pile of equity. That's when he can buy the cows and rent the farm from us.
Ginevra, what did you hear from farmers beyond just Jeep's comments there about this idea of who's going to get the farm when they're too old to run it?
In general, farmers do seem to want the farm to stay in the family and to stay as a farm. But they also recognize that initially a lot of them didn't go straight into farming. They left. They left and did something else, and then they came back and they settled into it and decided that was what they wanted to do. So it's certainly not a forced future for their children, you know, but it's scary then because there's no guarantee that the farm is going to continue to be a farm.
Christina, what would you add?
A lot of the farmers emphasized that they wanted their children to do what they wanted to do, and that their own path had been that they had left and come back and decided that this is what they wanted to do. But they also emphasized how important it is to really start the conversation early, to make sure they're really talking about it. Are you interested in coming back to the farm? How are we going to go through this? What's the process we want to take? Because it's not something you can do in a quick period of time. And all of them were saying, you know, it was a 10-year process or more, so.
Did everybody you interview have a succession plan, or were there any who said, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen?
We were surprised that almost everyone we talked to had a plan or had already started the process, which was something we didn't expect either. We also expected that some people were struggling with this, or we had heard a lot of statistics about there being a lot of older farmers who couldn't find younger successors. And we think maybe it's possible that just because the people we talked to happen to have the time to talk to us, and maybe there are bigger farms, that they had a plan in place, or it was just a big operation, so they had thought about it more than smaller farms, but we're not sure why.
Did you reach out to smaller farmers and they just didn't have the time, or how did you even choose who to talk to?
Well, we partner with the Agency of Agriculture, Ryan Patch, and he provided us with a list of farmers, and that ranged organic to inorganic, small, medium, large. And definitely the people who responded to us, we contacted everyone, but the people who responded, I'm sure, were the people who had the time and the resources. So once again, you know, in our podcast, we didn't talk to farmers who are really at the end of the rope, who are about to go out of business, because those aren't the ones that have the time to speak with other people.
And in the end, it was, I think, 9 farmers you talked to. Is that right?
Yep.
Or 9 farm families, at least.
Yeah.
One of the other issues that we do often hear about and that you talked about in the podcasts was this issue of diversification and how farmers are dealing with what to do beyond just dairy. And let's hear a little clip here from Steve Cahart of West Addison.
One of our weaknesses is that we have all of our eggs in one proverbial basket. So we're not really very diversified at all. We get paid for the milk that we sell every day, and that's really it. And I think that going forward in the future is what can we do to kind of broaden our income stream to help us so that when we have times of low prices that we can kind of insulate ourselves or help us a little bit so that we're not so susceptible to those downturns.
You can hear Steve there kind of wondering aloud about how to do that. What did you hear from farmers who have been thinking about how to diversify or who have done it?
Diversification, I think you hear a lot as a solution to farming struggles, but when you actually start to think about what that looks like, it becomes really complicated really quickly because now all of a sudden you have to be an absolute expert in not only dairy farming, but in whatever field you take on. So you have to have a lot of skills and a lot of expertise in multiple arenas. And I remember Steve, I was on that interview, and Steve definitely kind of acknowledged that fact in terms of, you know, what else do you expand to? Where do you get the skill set for that? Yeah, it's a really difficult question.
So when you talked to people like Steve about that, did you get a sense that this question of diversification was something that everybody agreed was necessary but difficult? Or did some people say, no, dairy is enough, you know, that diversification is not the answer to sustainability?
Definitely there is not a consensus that diversification was the answer. We read a lot of articles in preparation for this, a lot of academic articles and otherwise. And you read about these solutions like going organic, switching your dairy to organic or diversifying. But in reality, when you sit down and talk to farmers, that is, you know, there is no consensus about what the right direction is to go in.
I want to play one other cut of tape from your podcast here, and this is Jeep Madison again.
Fireman's been good to us. You know, a lot of people will never admit fireman's been good, but you look around and see a few Cadillacs parked here and there. And so fireman's been good to quite a few people.
I thought that was really interesting because, you know, you do hear a lot about the struggle of farming, but there's also money to be made. And Christina, maybe you can expand a little bit on that concept of making money in farming, because, you know, I think that is one of the areas where there's probably a lot of question marks about who's making money, how much money, is it a lucrative field? And here's Jeep saying, you know, not everybody's struggling. What do you think?
I think it definitely depends on a lot of factors, and a lot of the farmers recognize that, yes, it's a difficult field, but if you learn how to play it, if you learn how to ride the roller coaster, you could say, then you can be successful. And a lot of farmers we talked to had come up with some pretty interesting solutions to the challenges that they'd been struggling with. I mean, we talked to one farmer who'd invested in robotic milking, which had really helped them a lot. And we talked to Monument Farms, and they have this really interesting market strategy of producing their milk and selling it themselves. And so there's definitely ways to be successful in the dairy business.
What do you want people to know? I mean, you put these out not just as within your classwork and sharing with your classmates, but this is a podcast that theoretically anybody could listen to, and you've produced them. You know, you've done a lot of work to make these accessible to people beyond just your fellow classmates and your professors. So what's your aim here in trying to make sure people have a better understanding of the dairy industry? Ginevra?
A lot of communication is being dropped. So farmers communicate well with each other, but the public actually really doesn't have a very clear idea of what dairy farming entails at all. And certainly a lot of regulators, like the Agency of Agriculture, would like to hear more perspectives from farmers that they're missing out on. So I think our main goal is trying to at least help pick up some of those gaps and kind of make that connection between different parties.
Christina?
That was what we went into the project hoping, was that we identified one of the main ways we could help the industry was if we just had better communication between all parties and increasing the knowledge between all parties on what's really going on in everybody's perspective. And we thought, what better way to do that than through a podcast? So,
Ginevra has worked on dairy farms. Would any of the rest of your classmates or Christina, would you ever consider going into dairy?
Well, it's a difficult question because it seems like a really rewarding job, but it also seems like a challenging job and one that you definitely need to have a lot of expertise in. I was really impressed with the dairy farmers I talked to, and I don't know if I could do the same thing they do, but I'm really glad that they do it.
Christina Ohl and Ginevra Wetmore are both Middlebury seniors, and we have a link to their podcast that they did with other classmates. It's called Cow Talk, and you can find the link at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the rough sport of roller derby comes alive for young readers in St. Johnsbury. We'll explain just ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and now it's time for Dorothy's List, our monthly feature about the books nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Today, we hang out with kids in St. Johnsbury who are reading Victoria Jameson's book, Roller Girl. It's a graphic novel that dives into the fierce sport of roller derby. VPR's Amy Noyes takes us there.
They're all friends, by the way, but they act really tough, remember? The war face.
An oversized video monitor sits at the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum blaring rock music. On the screen, muscled women in short shorts, fishnet stockings, and roller skates are knocking each other down.
So if there's something kind of unseemly in it, close your eyes.
Adele West Fisher is the Youth Services Librarian at the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum, and she admits this isn't a typical activity for her group of readers amid the tall, arched windows and wood-paneled walls of the historic library. But if books are supposed to open up new worlds to the reader, then Roller Girl has hit its mark with these kids. The lead character is Astrid, who spends a summer at roller derby camp. She thought her best friend Nicole would be there with her, but Nicole goes to dance camp instead, and that leaves Astrid on her own to find her place at the roller rink. As Nicole spends more time with her dance friends, Astrid faces the possibility that she may also be on her own when they start middle school in the fall. That feeling of social anxiety pervades middle school, not just in fiction.
Is this based on real life? Like, is this a real story?
8-year-old Julia Spence is one of the kids in the St. Johnsbury reading group. We put Julia's question and questions from other young readers in the group to the author and illustrator of Roller Girl, Victoria Jameson.
I took a lot of things from real life. One of the biggest things I took from real life is that I had a best friend named Nicole. And when I was 12, we moved to a different state. And Nicole stayed in Pennsylvania. I moved to Florida. And it was a hard time to lose your best friend. You know, we try to stay friends, but eventually we just started to grow apart. So that part was true to life, and I wanted to put that, how much it hurts when you lose your best friend, into the book.
11-year-old Gabby Anzalone asked,
when did you get the first inspiration to write Roller Girl?
Well, I started playing roller derby quite a few years ago, back in 2008. And as soon as I started playing roller derby, I knew eventually I wanted to write a book about it. I wasn't exactly sure which kind of book I wanted to write. Most of my books before Roller Girl were for younger kids. They were picture books. And I knew roller derby was a little bit older, and I wanted to write for slightly older kids. So I didn't really decide to write Roller Girl until I read the book Smile by Raina Telgemeier. And those two things together, my playing roller derby and reading Smile, it clicked for me that a graphic novel was the perfect way to tell the story I wanted to tell.
12-year-old Josie Sestito wanted to know a little more about that.
Why did you write it as a graphic novel instead of a regular book?
I decided to write Roller Girl as a graphic novel because I've always felt more comfortable with illustrations rather than writing. I went to art school and I love to draw. I've always loved to draw ever since I was a kid. And when I write a book, I tend to think in pictures first.
11-year-old Ethan Spence wanted to know about the illustration process.
How did you do the art? Did you do it on a computer? Did you draw it? Did you sketch it first? How did you do the art?
When I visit schools across the country, I love to talk to kids about how I make the artwork because you really don't need anything special at all. I do my first sketches in a spiral notebook that I buy at the drugstore for 99 cents and a pencil. That's really all you need to make your own graphic novels, paper and a pencil. So that's how I do the first drafts. And when I do the final art, I just upgrade to paper and a pen. And that's how I draw it. I do add the color on a computer and the words on the computer, but you definitely don't need those tools to make your own graphic novels.
In the book, it's Astrid's mother who first introduces her to the wild and weird world of roller derby under the guise of, quote, cultural enlightenment. Here's Jameson reading from Roller Girl.
If you really want to know, it all began back in fifth grade, back when Nicole and I were still best friends. Okay, you two, in the car. Come on, Mom, can't you tell us where we're going? Nope, it's a surprise. Then Mom uttered the words that never failed to strike fear and dread into my heart. Tonight, we are having an evening of cultural enlightenment. This did not bode well for our Friday night. We'd experienced one or two of Mom's ECEs before. Poetry readings, the opera, and the Modern Art Gallery, to name a few. And those were the good trips. On the other hand, maybe tonight was starting to shape up. Hey, are we going to the amusement park? Not exactly. We got in a long line of strange-looking people. Mom, are you selling us to the circus? Mrs. V, I'm too young to be a carny. Keep it up, you two. I want to be the tattooed lady. No way, I want to be the tattooed lady. You can be the bearded lady. We went into this huge building that looked like an airplane hangar. Mom, can I get a tattoo? I want to dye my hair pink. Can I get a nose ring? Can I get a lip ring? Just as we sat down in the bleachers, hey, what is this place? The lights went out. Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for some roller derby?
In roller derby, players don't only have wild makeup, tattoos, and hair color. They also go by creative roller derby names. And Jameson says she had a good time researching names for her book.
That was a really fun part of writing the book, because there are 16 girls on her team that all needed roller derby names, and it's hard to come up with roller derby names. So I actually wrote to junior teams around the world. So there are skaters from Canada, Australia, Sweden, England, where else? Just all over the world and all over the United States. And I wrote to junior teams. Kids as young as 7 or 6 can play junior derby. And I asked if any of them wanted to have their names in the book. So kids would send in their names and their pictures. And that was a really fun part of writing the book.
And as for her own name?
My roller derby name is Winnie the Pow. I wanted to have a name that connected with children's literature. And a lot of the good ones, like Hermione Danger or like Pippi Strongstocking, were taken already. So I went with Winnie the Pow.
Fun roller derby monikers aren't the only names in the book. As St. Johnsbury sixth grader Logan McGregor points out, part of the story shows Astrid getting bullied in elementary school. He wondered why the author chose to include a particularly hurtful name in that scene.
When you gave Astrid the rude nickname that the kids that picked on her gave her, why was it inspired by a bad word and I didn't necessarily like it that much? I can relate to the book a bit because a lot of the kids in my class aren't necessarily that nice to me and it's kind of annoying and hard.
That's a good question. I've received a few questions from teachers and parents about the bad word in the book and whether it was appropriate or whether it was needed. And my own experiences from middle school was that kids could be mean and kids use bad words all the time. And I guess I included it in the book to show that sometimes kids will say mean things to you. And, you know, you can't leave it out of books just like you can't leave it out of life. And so I guess I put it in to show that Astrid was facing, she was getting bullied, and sometimes you get called bad names. And I wanted to show that it's not the end of the world if you get called a bad name. She, I think, is able to prove herself and get stronger despite maybe other kids making fun of her. It's not easy getting made fun of, but you can get through it.
And Astrid does emerge stronger. Despite being a novice skater, she sets her sights on becoming a roller derby jammer. That's sort of like a beginner football player aiming to be the quarterback. Most people who play roller derby are blockers. They try to block the progress of the jammer, who gets a point for every blocker she gets past. So a jammer needs to be fast and agile, and she needs to be able to get up after being knocked down. A lot. There's a picture on the book jacket of Roller Girl showing Jameson skating as a jammer with her team, the Rose City Rollers in Portland, Oregon. That prompted 10-year-old Ruby Mello to ask,
how long did it take for you to become a jammer in roller derby?
Roller derby, just like writing a graphic novel, takes a really long time to get good. So I'd say I was practicing for maybe 2 or 3 years. Our practice team is called Fresh Meat. That's what you join until you join a team. So I was maybe on Fresh Meat for about 2 or 3 years. And then I joined a team. And even when I was on a team, I wasn't always a jammer for games. Sometimes I'd be thrown in at the last minute if we were winning by 100 points or something. So I never actually became a super good jammer. And even just to get to the point of jamming, it took maybe 3 or 4 years.
Which is another life lesson in Roller Girl. Goals and friendships, if you want them badly enough, are worth working hard for, even if you have to take some lumps along the way. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is Roller Girl by Victoria Jameson. Thanks to the St. Johnsbury Youth Services librarian, Adele West Fisher. Next month, Dorothy's List will visit Waterville Elementary School, where readers will be discussing A Night Divided. It's a historical novel by Jennifer Nielsen about a family divided by the Berlin Wall. That's it for today. Tomorrow, the rise of Airbnb has led to debates over how rented rooms should be taxed and regulated, and how to keep the playing field fair for traditional inns and bed and breakfasts. We'll talk about the sharing economy and its impact on Vermont tourism and the hospitality industry. Send your questions and experiences to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us live tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.